Welcome back to The Drive with Kevin Weiss on ESPN Blacksburg, AM 1430, FM 94.1. In studio, we have Chris Coleman from Tech Sideline. Chris, how are you doing?
Doing well. How are you?
Doing very well. And of course, ACC Media Days just wrapped up. Anything interesting that you found from what Frank Beamer said and some of the players said? Anything that stood out to you at all?
I don't think so. At this point, I mean, Frank's in his 29th season now. He kind of says the same stuff every year at this point. I mean, if you heard it once, you've heard it a thousand times. I thought Kendall Fuller and Michael Brewer represented themselves well down there. They were very good choices to send down there for that. You know, I think the general consensus is that Virginia Tech's offense is a lot more experienced this year, and those guys have a lot more confidence in themselves this year as a result. That's really the main thing I took away from the media day, is just listening to Brewer say how much more confident he is this year. And he has a reason to be. You know, he's got a year under his belt now in a system that he was unfamiliar with at this point last year, but now he's very familiar with it. His receivers are no longer freshmen. He has a better offensive line in front of him. I think he's got a couple of proven running backs in J.C. Coleman and Trey Edmonds. So everything's setting up to be better this year if they can stay healthy.
Now, you mentioned the receivers a year more experience. Do you know if they added some weight or size or strength in the offseason?
Yeah. Isaiah Ford was noticeably bigger in the spring. Blocking was a big issue for him last year.
Right.
Blocking was an issue for all the receivers for the most part, but particularly for him, he just wasn't very big. So I think he took a step forward there in the spring. I think he probably put on about 10 pounds or so, 10 pounds of muscle in the offseason, and he might be even bigger now coming back after a summer under his belt. So that was a big focus, getting bigger and stronger, because edge blocking was a big issue last year.
With the depth and ability at the tight end spot, you were just talking about the wide receivers. You've got Bucky Hodges, Xavier Burke, and Ryan Malik at tight end, who are doing fantastically and should have a great season. Does that help with the depth issue at wide receiver at all?
Yeah, I think it does, because of the versatility of a couple of your tight ends. I mean, Bucky Hodges is basically a wide receiver. I don't remember one time last year where he lined up as a tight end with his hand on the ground. I mean, he was a wide receiver last year. He just wasn't called one in the media guide. He's capable of putting his hand on the ground, but, you know, in effect, he's going to be a wide receiver again this year. Calvin Klein has the ability to line up outside at wide receiver to a certain extent, and they even did that a little bit with Ryan Malik. So they've got some versatility with their tight ends. Xavier Burke is going to be the guy who's going to have his hand in the ground at all times, assuming he plays this year as a true freshman, which I think he probably will, because they need another tight end that can play with his hand in the ground. You know, at this point, I think Calvin Klein is scrappy, but he's a better receiver than blocker. And you know, I think Ryan Malik is really the only tight end they have who is a good inline blocker. So, you know, I think Xavier Burke's going to play this year, but they have enough versatility with their tight ends where that does mean that their lack of depth at wide receiver isn't going to hurt them quite as much as it would maybe a team that didn't have so much versatility at tight end.
Now, going back, did you get a chance to look at the depth chart that was released?
Yeah, it was about what I expected.
Okay.
Yeah.
So no surprises or anything?
I don't think, though. It was basically the same as it was at the end of the spring, even though they didn't officially release a depth chart at the end of the spring. That thing's going to look different, though, when practice opens, because C.J. Revis isn't going to be on there. So I think we'll see if that has some cause and effect in the secondary as far as moving guys around at different positions. I know Frank Beamer mentioned Chuck Clark as a potential candidate Rover, as well as free safety. And you know, I would really like him to play free safety. I think he would be kind of wasted at Rover, because he has such good coverage skills, but those skills aren't needed as much at Rover as they would be at free safety or nickel or cornerback.
Now, I was reading the website, and you mentioned C.J. Revis, and I think it brought up the question in one of the Q&A sessions that you do on Fridays about Holland Fisher, a safety out of high school, highly ranked, four-star recruit. What's his story? What happened to him?
You know, he was highly ranked. He had a good offer list. Alabama offered him, and he looks the part. He's a very gifted athlete, thus his high ranking. But, you know, if you really dig into it deeper, you know, he's a guy that struggled to qualify, did not qualify out of high school, had to go to prep school, you know, was actually suspended from high school during his signing day ceremony, which is kind of a red flag. And so I think there were some maturity issues there at one point. I don't think there are now. I think he's okay now. But the main thing is he played middle linebacker in high school, and he was just not used to covering people. And if you play safety in college, you've got to cover people, and that's just not a skill you can pick up overnight.
Right.
So it's not that he was overrated coming out of high school. It's just people looked at his rating and said, oh, my gosh, he's going to play right away. But when in actuality, that rating was more about his ceiling rather than where he was right then and there as a football player. So you got to be patient with Hyland Fisher because he really had never covered anybody before, you know, that 1 year of prep school. So just because he was a top 100, top 150 guy, you still got to take into account that he's got to learn a whole new skill set. It's like moving a shortstop or second baseman to left field, right?
Right.
He might be a top prospect, but if you move him when you get up to AAA, it's going to take him longer to reach the majors because he's got to learn a completely different position.
Now, you mentioned he didn't qualify right away. Do you think? And I've just been, the past couple weeks, seeing that Eric Whitehead didn't qualify, Adonis Williamson didn't qualify, Mike Arnold's going to prep school.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that Virginia Tech's going to kind of steer their focus away from those guys at all or continue to recruit them just because of their talent?
I think you recruit guys who are good players. In general, I don't think you want to recruit guys who have no hope of qualifying. You want to recruit guys who, they might be a little borderline. Maybe they'll make it, maybe they won't. And a lot of these guys, that's the case. They're very, very close. You just don't know how they're going to finish up. Ironically, the guy that looked like he was furthest away from qualifying was Tim Settle, and he ended up qualifying, which is, give that guy a pat on the back. That was an amazing job. But I don't think you do anything different as far as that regard, as far as that goes. Virginia Tech hasn't taken a JUCO football player, though, since 2003 with James Griffin. Once Tech got into the ACC, they stopped recruiting JUCO players, and I think the line has always been that if they weren't original qualifiers out of high school, then they weren't going to take JUCO recruits.
Right.
And that pretty much rules out most JUCO recruits. So that's going to be interesting to see what happens to Whitehead and Adonis Williamson because they are going the JUCO route, and Virginia Tech has not taken a JUCO recruit since 2003. So 2 years from now, we'll see if they're still on board with Virginia Tech or if Virginia Tech's still on board with them.
Do you agree with that philosophy?
I think it depends on the person.
Right.
If I think it's a good kid and he's not going to upset the locker room, then I take him.
Yeah.
And I try to get him as much help as I can without going all University of North Carolina type deal. If he's a good kid and he's going to represent the university in the right way, then I wouldn't have a problem taking him.
Yeah, because I was living in Big 12 country a year ago, and that's what Bill Snyder was known for. I mean, he just it's walk-ons, junior college recruits.
Oh, yeah.
And he does very successful. Same thing with Bobby Petrino at Louisville. He brings in a lot of JUCO guys and some questionable character guys, but they're impactful players.
There's some places where you don't have any choice but to do that. Like in Kansas, there's no high school talent, but there's a number of JUCOs out there. So that's how you build your program. West Virginia, I mean, you don't have but 5 or 10 players in West Virginia that sign with Division I schools every year. So you have to take maybe some academically questionable kids. You've got to go down and recruit Florida and things like that. Some schools, they just don't have any choice. Probably the same thing at Louisville, where there's not a ton of talent in the state of Kentucky either.
Yeah, you're right about that. I grew up in the Louisville area for 15 years, and there may be 6-7 really good prospects. Other than that, whoever the coach was, Bobby Petrino, Charlie Strong, they were looking at Florida.
Absolutely.
And the other states, Georgia, Ohio, and places like that. Now, you brought up West Virginia, and Joe and I were having a kind of a fun conversation yesterday about, there was news about Bob Bowlesby coming out and saying that the Big 12 is not going to expand anytime soon. And we just hypothetically said, if West Virginia or if the Big 12 dissolves, which two teams would the ACC get? Assuming, the ACC gets 2, the Big 10 gets 2, the SEC gets 2, and the Pac-12 gets 4, which two Big 12 teams would wind up in the ACC?
Oh, I would want West Virginia.
See, we agree.
A lot of Tech fans would disagree with that because of some bad experiences with West Virginia fans in the past. But I also think our football has been a lot more boring since West Virginia came off the schedule. Hatred is good in college football.
Absolutely.
In general life, no, you don't want to hate people or anything like that. But hating other teams, that's part of the beauty of sports. UVA's been so terrible for so long. You can still hate them, but they haven't been a threat.
Right.
So I would like to have a little more bitterness when it comes to rivalries and things like that. So I welcome playing West Virginia again, and I'm glad we're doing it. And if something happened and they were available and the ACC wanted to take them, then that would be perfectly fine with me. The problem is these conferences are too big already.
Yeah.
I mean, Virginia Tech is scheduled to play Louisville one time between 2015 and 2024. We'll see what the they haven't released the ACC opponents for 2025 yet. But in that same time span, they're going to play 11 different games against Big Ten opponents.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, what's up with that? What's up with the Louisville thing? I mean, is that just a scheduling error?
I just think it's as big as conferences are these days, you're never going to have balanced scheduling. And since you play the same, you have one crossover opponent every year, you know, it makes it even more difficult. So the bigger these conferences get, it's going to make it seem like those guys on the other side, in the other division, are in a completely different conference, with the exception of Boston College, of course, which is, you know, I wish we had a different crossover opponent.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm with you on West Virginia. You know, and hopefully ending up, or if the Big 12 dissolved, they'd wind up in the ACC, just because it makes the most sense geographically out of that conference. And then not only with Virginia Tech, but the other rivalries from the Big East days with Louisville and Syracuse and Pittsburgh, I think would make the most sense. I guess there was some guy on Twitter that was, you know, tweeting us back and forth. But
a lot of people don't like the idea of West Virginia being in the conference. They just don't like West Virginia, period.
They don't like West Virginia, period. But, and they question West Virginia's academics as far as them letting underperforming students in to play football and things like that. But guess what? Louisville does the same thing, and we already took Louisville. Mm-hmm. So you can't really use that excuse anymore.
Oh, no, you're 100% right. I know some people that got into Louisville that shouldn't have gotten to college first place.
Yeah.
So that is I agree with you on that point. We're talking to Chris Coleman from TechSideline.com. We've got much more coming up next on The Drive with Kevin Weiss on ESPN Blacksburg, AM 1430, FM 94.1. Welcome back to The Drive with Kevin Weiss on ESPN Blacksburg, AM 1430, FM 94.1. We've got Chris Coleman from TechSideline.com in studio. And Chris, also at ACC Media Days, the predictions from the media guys out there on who's going to win the Coastal and Atlantic and everything like that. Any thoughts on that, on Virginia Tech being picked second and just the ranking that everybody put out there?
That's what I thought they would be picked. I thought they would be picked second with Georgia Tech first. Interestingly enough, this is the first time since the ACC split into divisional formats that either Virginia Tech or Miami has not been picked to win the Coastal Division.
Mm.
And in that span, of course, Miami never won the Coastal Division, even when they were picked for it half those years. That's just how they rolled. And they kept getting picked year after that. You know, and it's like, haven't you people figured it out that they're just not as good as they were in the 80s anymore? You know, you still got to keep picking them first. But, the five times in the last 10 years that the media got their prediction right as far as who's going to win the Coastal Division, it was Virginia Tech. Unfortunately, Virginia Tech has never finished higher than they were picked. Like any of those years they were picked to finish second or third, they never finished higher than they were picked. So past history tells us that they will not win the Coastal Division this year. Now, that being said, I think their schedule sets up pretty well. It sets up better than Georgia Tech's. Mm-hmm. If it truly does come down to Georgia Tech and Virginia Tech, the Hokies don't have to play Clemson or Florida State. Georgia Tech has to play both of those teams. So that's an advantage for Virginia Tech, and I don't think a lot of people are talking about that. You know, Miami last season, they were picked to win the Coastal last year, and they had to play Florida State.
Yeah.
And you know, they didn't end up winning it, and they weren't close to winning it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But I look at schedules, and I don't know if all guys who vote do that or not.
Yeah.
But just based on looking at that schedule, I think Virginia Tech has the advantage on paper. Of course, that doesn't mean that they're going to go out and win it, but I think you certainly have to put them in the conversation because of that.
Yeah, Georgia Tech could be a better team, but there's a potential for four or five losses easily on that schedule.
Yep.
Now, do you see maybe a dark horse in the Coastal, if not Virginia Tech or Georgia Tech?
Yeah, I would say UNC, and it depends on how Gene Chizik, you know, their new defensive coordinator, gets their defense turned around. They got to get back to basics there. They were not a physical defense. They couldn't cover anybody. They just didn't look like the last few years they've taken any pride in themselves as far as the players go with UNC. So I think their offense is good. I think Larry Fedora knows what he's doing offensively. They got a redshirt senior quarterback with a ton of experience who's very talented. They've got good weapons at wide receiver, solid enough running game, solid offensive line. I think if their defense can just be average – then they could compete for the Coastal Division Championship. They're kind of the opposite of Virginia Tech, whereas if Virginia Tech's offense was just average, then I think they'd win the Coastal Division pretty much every year. And I think you could maybe say the same thing for UNC's defense, but they've been so bad for so long now. We'll see how quickly he's able to turn that around.
And we've been kind of, with some of the guests we've had on this week, we've been kind of going through and asking them who they think is going to be Offensive Player of the Year and Defensive Player of the Year. So if I was to give you a guy for Offensive Player of the Year, are there a couple of guys that you've got in mind?
You know, I really like Deshaun Watson. Can he stay healthy? But yeah, as much as I saw Justin Thomas last year and as many times as he's going to get to run the football in that offense, you know, it's just going to be like a personal preference on whichever voter. You know, I think if Clemson makes it to the ACC championship game and Deshaun Watson stays healthy, he'll probably be the Offensive Player of the Year. But if Florida State wins that division and maybe Georgia Tech wins the Coastal, then I think Justin Thomas has a legit chance to win it. So I think it's going to be one of those two guys offensively. Defensively, I think the best player and the best defensive player in the league is Kendall Fuller. That's my opinion there. But how many times is he going to get the ball thrown in his general direction? Right. So he's a possibility. I'm inclined to think it's going to be a defensive lineman. So Daddy Nicholas might have as good a chance as anybody.
Yeah, and I think going back, they rarely have a defensive back that's picked to win Defensive Player of the Year. And speaking of defensive linemen, you did a really good two-part series on D-line production. And wanted to ask you a couple questions regarding that. Nigel Williams, underappreciated. Why is the reasoning for him being underappreciated, you think?
You know, he's just, the only time he started is when somebody else got hurt, like when Luther Matty got hurt last year. So he's not considered a starter by most Tech fans. But, you know, when you look at his plays per sack and plays per tackle for loss, he's making more plays in a lower number of snaps than you know, your regular starters are. And you can even go back to most Tech defensive tackles in the past, on a per-play basis, Nigel Williams is more productive than any of them. And that could be a small sample size. I think that was the case for his first year. I think he played around 200 snaps that year and had 7 tackles for loss, which is just insane for 200 snaps. But he's a good player. I loved his film coming out of high school. I think he's got quickness for a defensive lineman and good size. And as far as I'm concerned, Tech has 3 starting caliber defensive tackles right now, and maybe more if a couple of those other backups develop.
Do you think with more of that depth that they'll lower the snap count of some of these guys?
I hope so. I when you look at their most productive guys in the past, David Pugh, you know, he had his most productive season when he had played fewer than 500 snaps. And I remember back in 2011, I think, when Derek Hopkins played 770 snaps or something like that. Halfway through the season, the first 7 games, he had 5 tackles for loss and 3 sacks. And then he had no tackles for loss, no sacks over the last 6 games of the season. It's almost like he got worn out. He was playing too many snaps. So, yeah, I do think the more players that you can work in there as a defensive lineman, you can keep your guys fresh because you're going 100% all the time as a defensive lineman, or at least you're supposed to. I mean, that's the position on the field that really playing harder probably than any other position except for maybe the offensive line. You got to pin your ears back at all times, and ideally you want to have a 2-deep worth of players up front because I think that helps keep everybody fresh and makes everybody more productive.
Speaking of needing time off probably more than any other, the offensive line really has a depth issue. Mm-hmm. What are they going to do to keep those guys as fresh as they can be so that the 6, 7, or maybe even 8 guys who consistently will play are actually going to be fresh on a down-to-down basis?
That's a great question. I'm not sure if they trust any of their backups to be on the field right now. I don't, you know, we'll see. We'll see where Kyle Chung is when he comes back. He's had so many injuries now and missed so much time in the weight room that I'm not sure how physically strong he is right now. I'm not sure if he's physically strong enough to handle the load. Darius Redmond, I thought, did a good job this spring, and maybe with some more time, he could be that third offensive tackle that could maybe get some snaps here and there. But basically, you're talking about, you've got to play Yasuo Nijman right now at offensive tackle, and he's a true freshman that everybody was recruiting as a defensive lineman, and he gets moved to offensive tackle his first, you know, 5 practices in the spring, and he's maybe your third best offensive tackle right now. I mean, that's really shows a lack of depth. So I'm not sure they're going to be able to rotate guys on the offensive line this year. I think even tired, I think your starters are going to be in better. You're going to be better off with your starters in there than any of those backups. Now that can change with some more development time. And the good thing is, these backups, they do have time to develop, because all five of these starters will be coming back for 2016. So it's not like we need any of them to be good really quickly. If everybody can stay healthy, that's going to be a good unit, but that's a big if, of course.
Yeah.
Now, one of my concerns, and I don't know if it may concern you or not, but Eric Gallo, just a sophomore, stepping right in as a center. I mean, that's a very important position for making the calls and just being a leadership position and keying everything in with the offense. Do you have any concerns about that at all, or you think he's going to be okay?
You know, I have some, but I also have a gut feeling that he's going to be an upgrade over the centers that Virginia Tech have had the past couple of years. I thought he did a good job in the spring. I was sitting next to one of Tech's former offensive linemen for one of the spring scrimmages, and I said, well, besides Wyatt Teller, who's the best offensive lineman on the field right now? And he said, from what I've seen today, Eric Gallo is. He's a guy that's soaked up the playbook. I think he's physically stronger at the point of attack than guys like David Wang and Caleb Ferris. So I actually think he has the potential to be an upgrade. I'm not saying it's going to happen in week one against Ohio State, but week four, week five, week six, once he gets some experience under his belt, I think he'll be an upgrade.
Now, speaking of offensive linemen, I guess you have kind of an issue with offensive linemen on the recruiting trail, or just Virginia Tech not being able, just having trouble with landing the offensive linemen that they're looking for.
Yeah, you know, they used not to target very many offensive linemen, and I think that caught up with them. I know the 2010-2011 recruiting classes, they only signed four offensive linemen combined over those 2 years, and only one of them ever became a contributor. And that's why Virginia, they had issues in 2012, 2013, and 2014 on the field. You can directly point to those two classes. The lack of success in those two classes is why they didn't have any offensive linemen the last few years, or any good offensive linemen, really, or not enough good offensive linemen is how I should phrase that. I think they're having a little trouble this year. I think they're going to sign some good offensive tackles. I like the Hopple kid from the 757. I think they'll probably get Patrick Kearns, who's I believe from Georgia, but they seem to be struggling with their interior linemen. Landon Dickerson was a tackling early. He's visiting right now. Actually, he's on campus today. But the longer that goes, he really likes Stacy Searles, but he's afraid that Stacy Searles won't be his coach here long term because of Frank's age and you know, impending retirement at some point in the next couple of years, most likely. And that's a legitimate concern. I mean, if you want to come here because of Stacy Searles, you probably need to rethink things. So that's a legitimate concern. I don't think we're going to get him. Love Giancarlo Valentin, but the competition there is very, very stiff. And Searles is a great recruiter. He's the reason we're in it for a lot of these guys, but there's not early playing time available on the offensive line right now. And, you know, the whole when is Frank Beamer going to retire, who's my coach going to be thing is hurting him too. The reason they're in it with so many good wide receivers because all those guys know they have an opportunity to come in and play next year as true freshmen and get a lot of snaps as true freshmen. So that's why they're having a lot of success at wide receiver this year.
Now, how much of a drop-off do you think there is from a Landon Dickerson to a plan B or a plan C guy that they have to go to in terms of skill set and just in terms of an offensive lineman overall?
It's a big drop-off. Yeah. I love Landon Dickerson. I think he's very much like Wyatt Teller. I think he's big. He's physical. He's listed as an offensive tackle. I think he certainly can play that in college, but I think he also might be a really, really good guard, too. And at any rate, he's one of those five offensive linemen. Figure out your top five and you put him on the field. He's one of those guys. So that would be a big drop-off, in my opinion. He was their top target from day one up front.
We've got Chris Coleman from TechSideline.com in studio. We'll wrap up with him. You're listening to The Drive with Kevin Weiss on ESPN Blacksburg, AM 1430, FM 94.1. Welcome back to The Drive with Kevin Weiss on ESPN Blacksburg, AM 1430, FM 94.1. I see you've got the Rocky theme going, Joe.
Absolutely.
I've actually never seen that movie, believe it or not. Never
no
seen
kidding.
Rocky.
No kidding.
I've got it on Netflix on the queue, but I just haven't checked it out.
Maybe
yet.
You can go see Creed when it comes out, and you can watch them in reverse order.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, gosh. They would get better on
Rocky. All right. So I think this was also a question on one of the Q&A sessions you did on Tech Sideline, but outside of Tim Settle and Dwayne Lawson possibly playing, are there other kind of lesser-known freshman that you see could play right away?
Yeah, it's certainly possible. I think I like a guy like Chris Cunningham. Tech needs a bigger receiver this year, and has an outside possibility of playing. Like if he can pick up the playbook quick enough. I don't think it's going to happen, but I do think it's an outside possibility. And then you look in the secondary. Mook Reynolds is going to play some kind of a role, I think, even if it's on special teams, because I know they expect to lose Kendall Fuller after this season. They expect Mook Reynolds to step into a starting role next year as a true sophomore. So he's going to play this year. Carson Lydon is going to play at Mike. If Matua Puaka does not play well at the beginning of the season, then I could see Carson Lydon pushing him by the middle of the season as he gets more time in the system and things like that. But at the very least, he'll play special teams this year. So, yeah, there's several other guys who have a chance this year.
Do you think Matua Puaka will play well at linebacker?
I don't know, man. I have my doubts. I just watched what Trey Edmonds did to him in the spring game and just ran right up the middle and just shoved him off of him like he was nothing. And, you know, he had some issues last year. I remember he really struggled to tackle that Duke running back in the open field a couple of times. And so we'll see. The jury's still out. I think he's capable, but I've seen enough things from him where I'm like, oh boy, I really hope we can cover him up against Ohio State because, you know, Urban Meyer's going to find a way to go right after him.
So over and looking at a different sort of view of everything, Tech is having a real transitional period. That's kind of where we're hitting. We're hitting the beginning of that real big transition period between the Beamer era and whatever comes next. When you look back at the Beamer era after it's all done, year, 2 years, 3 years, however many years it is from now when it's over, what will be your biggest takeaway and biggest memory?
I think the biggest memory will probably be playing for the national championship. My biggest takeaway, though, is how different the campus looks, in particular the athletic department portion of the campus. And, you know, Jim Weaver deserves a lot of credit for that, but at the same time, those seats aren't filling up, and we're not making near as much money without the success of Frank's football program. So to me, that part of campus looks so different. I mean, where the practice fields are now is totally different from where they were in the 1990s. I mean, they were over there where, like, their lacrosse practice fields are right now. There was no indoor practice facility. There was no south end zone. There weren't as many bleachers in the north end zone. The Merriman Center didn't even exist until 1998. So, and all those all the bigger additions to the softball stadium, the soccer fields, and stuff like that, that's all paid for with money that football generates. So to me, I mean, Frank Beamer has built that entire athletic department, and that's going to be, to me, that's his biggest legacy whenever he decides to retire from Virginia Tech. The success that his football program had is the reason that place looks the way it looks today, because it just looked so different 20, 25 years ago when you drive into that place. And, you know, sometimes, I bet for a lot of people, if you came back and you hadn't been here to this campus in 25 years or something like that, then you'd be in for a big shock.
I do remember playing football with my friends while watching Tech games. We'd bring a football to the stadium and we'd stand there and we'd watch like 50 feet away from us they were playing, and we're just having a good old time.
Oh, yeah.
Half caring about what was going
on. You could lay out and take a nap at halftime or something if you really wanted to. Yeah, it was big changes.
So what do you believe a search for a new coach, when it eventually happens, should look like? Should it be something that's in-house, or should it expand to, you know, across the country?
It'll expand across the country. I mean, if you just look at Whit Babcock's past as your evidence. He loses Butch Jones to Tennessee. Well, guess what? He had already been doing his research. He kind of saw that coming, or even if he didn't see it coming, he always had guys on his list. Like, okay, if my coach leaves, here's the first person I'm calling. I think he hired Tommy Tuberville the day after Butch Jones left. So he already knew who he was going to hire. I think he knows who he wants to hire now. We'll see. We'll see if that comes to pass. And when you look at what he did here with Buzz Williams, I mean, he tries to hit a home run. I mean, he even said that. He's directly quoted. He said, my hiring philosophies are I like to hit a home run early. He doesn't want the search to drag out, because the longer it drags out, the more it impacts recruiting, the more your fan base is in limbo, wondering who it's going to be. So, I think he whenever the situation happens, whenever it happens, whenever Frank retires, what's going to be prepared for it? He's going to have a list of three or four guys, and he's going to move very, very quickly. And wouldn't shock me if he had a coach hired within a week.
And hopefully he doesn't have to use a search firm, right? I think he could probably make that decision on his own.
He doesn't need to use a search firm.
At USF, where I come from, they use a search firm every time, and they always screw up their coaching hire.
I don't think you only use a search firm if you're like a real small program, and you're not going to get a big-name guy, so there's not a lot of information out there on guys who are interested. But if you're at a big program and you're in a situation like Witt, when you know your coach is going to retire in a year or two, or you probably already knew coming in that you were going to have to fire James Johnson at some point, you're already doing your background research. You're making these contacts with agents and stuff and lawyers that nobody knows about. So, I mean, he's already working that. I can guarantee you. I'd bet my house that he's already working the back channels.
All right. Well, thank you, Chris.